You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Jared Stacy, and he is a theologian and an ethicist and a former pastor to evangelical churches in New Orleans and Washington, D.C. metro area. He received a PhD in moral and practical theology from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. His research focuses on the intersection of theology and politics, specifically on ethics, extremism, conspiracy theory, and U.S. evangelism, and that's why he's on the show with us today. His work has been featured on NPR and NBC and BBC and Time magazine, and his new book is called Reality in Ruins. And the book description says that conspiracy theories are at the root of the most pressing political problems of our time, yet their influence cuts just as personal. Suspicion has fractured families, it's true. Communities and churches are very social fabric, as one person's fact is another's fake news. It is wonderful to talk to someone who has such a great amount of knowledge and who cares about the issue, who cares about it socially, but who cares about it personally. Here is Jared now. I am delighted to have Jared Stacy with us today. I am eager to start our conversation. I wrote down so many notes in preparation. I would love to have you take a moment, though, and introduce yourself, and then we'll start talking. Go for it.
Well, thank you for having me on, Rachel. You know, I'm Jared Stacy. I'm a PhD in theology and ethics and the author of Reality and Ruins, How Conspiracy Theory Became an Evangelical Crisis. It's not an academic book in the traditional sense. Readers will find it's my story that is interwoven. This topic is something that is sort of right on the surface of our political moment and a lot of our personal lives. I was raised inside this community, so it wasn't a topic that, you know, sitting on the shelf of research that you could do. This is personal for me. So for listeners to know a little bit about me, you know, I was raised in fundamentalist evangelical Christianity. I went to Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. I was a Southern Baptist pastor in New Orleans and near DC in so many different ways, put distance between myself and that brand, that form of Christianity, quite literally. Went to Scotland for about 3 years while I was sifting through my own ruins in a book that is titled that way. And that's all very much intentional. And so as someone who's from these spaces, people ask me about conspiracy theories and the association with evangelical Christianity. And I just have to say it's personal. I grew up hearing and receiving and automatically just associating some of these spurious facts or data or whatever, just as part of what it meant to be Christian. I've used the analogy since of I inherited it as sort of a casserole just baked in. And I know that hopefully will resonate with a lot of your listeners. And so that's a little bit about me. I'm an academic. I'm also a chaplain here in the Tampa Bay area. That's the work I do now and kind of straddling the divide between the academy and real life. It's a place where I feel very much at home and at peace. And I do appreciate the work that you do in allowing those who make their way. We all make our way out in various ways and different pathways. And so there's definitely some resonance there. That's the long short of it, Rachel, but thank you for having me on today.
Of course, my pleasure. I want to just spend a moment talking about that transition for you, that there are people who are raised in any kind of cocoon, but also one where they feel like this is where God exists and this is what God wants. And this is where their community is and this is where their family is. So it's one thing to say, okay, I left this and now I'm involved in this, but I guess I want people to understand the emotional and spiritual gravity of leaving what felt like a, I'm sure, a cocoon, your own world, and the loss of people also who are still there and sometimes not knowing what you're going to have next and if you're going to have a theology that you can connect with, or you have to kind of find your own. Because when people talk about it, even on the show, and they talk about their experiences, they'll say, oh, I left this, and then I needed to find this. I want people to feel what that experience is like, the wrenching of it, even if it's gradual, but still what that feels like.
I think it's probably helpful for me to describe it. I mean, it happened not in an instant. It was very much a slow holding space for grief. I think even since the book has kind of gone public and come out, it was surprising to me to find, you know, there were still reservoirs of grief that I hadn't fully excavated or explored. And I think part of that also speaks to, and I've heard this from people who have had similar childhoods or experiences, that a cocoon is intentional. It can be good. It can be safe in some respects, that experience. And the complexity of it matches the depths of the loss and the pain. Because there are good memories, because there are positives alongside almost paradoxical negatives, that makes even trying to narrate it almost impossible. Wrenching yourself away or finding yourself in a new area. I resonate a lot with one of the stories in scripture, Hagar in the book of Genesis. And for readers who may not count themselves as Christian, I hope that at least this story will provide some sort of anchor without this coercion. But just Hagar's experience, she was abused, used as a sort of man-made attempt to bring about something God had promised, which was an heir. And she was basically kicked out of her home. And she's found in the desert wandering, and God comes to her. God asks, you know, where are you going? And she says, well, I know where I've come from, but I don't know where I'm going. On this side of things, I suppose it's easier to say because I have found a way of being Christian again. There has been, in a cocoon sense, a sort of rebirth. And yet, when you're going through it, to go through it honestly, it does mean putting all the cards on the table. Maybe I won't be Christian. Maybe this is the end. And without that honest admission, that's very much where I was. And in many ways, could be again. That's the important thing to keep in mind is as you go through those sorts of experiences and that wrenching away from community. I don't mind sharing this with you and your listeners, Rachel, but I'm back in my hometown. Like, this is where I was raised. There are overlaps. There are still relationships that persist across a huge chasm of change in my life. And I've found myself appealing in many times to the kid I was, to people who don't understand who I've become, trying to insist that in some ways, I'm still very much the same person. I'm still very much the same child who has been changed and who has made different decisions. But the complexity of that, it almost defies my ability to explain fully. And maybe that's also because I'm still figuring it out. I'm still reorienting myself to what it means to be back and what it means to have elements of my life still very much adjacent to spaces that were once very familiar and safe. It highlights different growth edges, but I think in some way, that experience of pain or loss for people, I wish more people understood that it's not something you choose, that it's not a conscious choice. For me, at least, it was several pebbles in my shoe over many years that eventually just led to a crisis. And when we boil down what crisis involves choice. And not everyone has the choice. Not everyone has that ability to choose sometimes. I look at the loss involved and the pain involved. For myself, the pain of staying became greater than the pain of going. And I write about that a little bit in the book, that the pain of changing your mind, when that pain is less than the pain of continuing to try and hold together disparate parts of a form of truth that smuggles in lies, that cognitive strain is not just in an intellectual problem. Because I know many people who continue to go along with that cognitive strain. Why? Because of the deep belonging that is promised if you just turn your head away, turn your mind off from the contradictions that express themselves. And in that sense, it appears to me that one of the great things that the book is trying to do is create a safe place for people to say, like, I don't know, because the belonging. As a child, you think of things in terms of a cocoon, and that can be healthy. It can also have its downsides in what is forming you. But as an adult, when you leave some of these spaces, you're not just thinking of cocoons anymore. You're thinking of patronage. You're thinking of your work networks. That was all put on the table. That was all part of the, I know where I've come from, but I don't know where I'm going. That's sort of existential, the cocoon, the processing, like this is where I came from. But then also in a very real material sense, who's going to hire you? Those are the questions that you ask.
Interesting. It does get practical. A couple things from what you've said so far. First, yes, the character or the person, however you think of biblical people, Hagar, I'm going to use the probably Hebrew pronunciation. So same person, Hebrew pronunciation. Hagar is someone I grew up learning about, and it was sort of going into the void, going into the unknown, and that there are a lot of communities now that use Hagar as this beacon of really understanding of being in that space, like people who are transitioning, people who don't know what life will become for them as they become who they feel they've always supposed to have been. But what will it look like? What would it feel like? How will they be received? And it's a very relatable space and well said in the Bible. I think what's also interesting is this idea of not knowing that here you're back in your hometown and all that that brings. And these are decisions, I think, that we make throughout our life. But to not feel like these decisions are necessarily etched in stone. When you're raised in a more fundamentalist anything, you're supposed to have a sense of what you're supposed to be doing and where you're supposed to be doing it. But to then back away from that and see that life is about change and it's about checking in with you along the way to see if this is what you need and if this is what's working for you. And just because you've made a decision that works for you now doesn't mean it might next year. And it might, but it might not. And to be open to that, that no one else gets to dictate that for you any longer. You get to speak to yourself in that way, which I think is very, very powerful. But it's connected to this idea of belonging. There's something very nice about the familiar.
And especially when in those communities where in so many ways, there are those voices who essentially claim to speak for God. And I appreciate the Hebrew pronunciation for Agar. Thank you for that.
No, it isn't a right or wrong. It's just the way I grew up hearing it. It's just different.
What I love about that interaction is that she becomes the first person in the Bible to name God. The God who sees is how she experienced God. And that acknowledgement, because you grew up in those spaces where you experience people who claim to speak for God and the culture, right? In those spaces that is sort of an extension of those voices, you very much learn how to perform. You drive a wedge between honesty and what is acceptable in that place. In so many ways, conspiracy theory, just as a storytelling act, as something that kind of emerges out of these communities to sort of narrate what's going on out there, is very much related to how those communities make it so that to ask one question is to implicate another. You know, to ask, was this election stolen, is to sort of drag in, well, what do we believe about Jesus? And high control environment shuts down that conversation almost immediately because it's a dying star collapsing in on itself. The gravity of it pulls everything into itself as a way to save itself. It can feel like self-protection. It's splitting you in two. And I think the recognition that I found, God met me in the admission of that environment, was surprising. I keep coming back to that word of at the moments where I felt like there was something else. And I think when you get a taste for the freedom that exists on the other side of that, there's really no going back. And even in my situation, even in coming back, now there is a responsibility in some ways to live out that freedom in ways that is an invitation. Since I've come back, it's been amazing how many people have gone in a similar space here. We've all come to very similar conclusions through crises. That has been affirming alongside of the more common questions of, well, what happened to you? I understand that they may be well-meaning. You don't talk to someone for 20 years and we see what each other posts on the internet. Well, how do we know each other through that? We can't. But I remember very much what those spaces can do and be, and the belonging there makes it so that it's very difficult to step out of that void, to really be surprised, because the control and the certainty go hand in hand, don't they, in those cultures?
They really, really do. I want to be able to talk about the idea of reality. I have kids who are now young adults, and I think, what is it like for them to now be emerging into the world, not knowing even if someone they're talking to is real? A video that they're watching, is it AI? Was it created? Is this a real person? I don't know how you adapt to that and have a sense of what is and what isn't. I remember the first time I was young and someone said, well, it depends on what your version of reality is. That expression has always stayed with me because I thought, isn't there one version? Isn't there reality? Then there's fantasy, or looking through it in a psychologically distorted way, like paranoia and other sorts of things. But just the idea that there really isn't one collective reality really blew my mind. The other thing that is connected to this, I think, actually is woven into this idea of belonging, because when I work with a lot of people who were involved in cults, Oftentimes, the cult called itself your family. A person's name was often changed by the leader, or they would need to come up with a name that was in line with that way of thinking or that tradition. Then they lost their identity. They lost their family. Now they have a new family. Where is reality in this? But I think sometimes people forfeit that for community, for family, for what, however that gets defined. And a lot of people will say, I stayed for much longer in whatever it was, even a bad marriage, because I just didn't want to be spiraling out in the world alone. So they were unhappy for much longer than people realized before they made a change, before they did what you said, which is that they realized that as kind of unhappy as they were, you still had to make a change, as uncomfortable as it was.
Sometimes the pain you know is preferred to the pain you don't. And the choices that present, though, in the midst of that sort of crucible are different for everyone. They also depend on time, that someone comes across your path or you listen to a podcast or you hear the right thing at the right time. I'm thinking specifically of how when I went to do my PhD, and I told people this, I don't recommend doing a PhD in theology on the heels of sort of an existential crisis of faith. For my life, it was actually probably the best thing that could have happened, if only because people usually arrive in a PhD program, not just decided upon what they want to study, but as the capstone of everything they've already studied. I had the education to show for, like, okay, I'm ready to do this. But what made it different and unique was that I was grappling with a tradition of Christianity that publicly was essentially betraying its own commitment to what Christianity is. January 6th happened a week before I left for Aberdeen. And my time in Aberdeen was this very unique then 3 years of just being around particular people in a particular place. It was that sort of proximity was its own form of healing without the academic pursuits that took place there. I think for listeners who may find themselves in these positions now, I think one thing I could say is it doesn't have to be getting your passport, but it will involve choice. But the safety to make that choice is very difficult because you don't know what's on the other side. You know what you have to deal with here. You don't know what you're going to have to deal with out there. And that's a terrifying thought.
It is a terrifying thought. Before we jump into small subjects like extremism and conspiracy theories, everyday things.
Yeah, just light banter.
Light banter. I love that. I'm a lot of fun at parties. Can you tell? So
I get that a lot too. Yeah.
Right? There are some personalities where I think I'm unfortunately one of them, where I like to push the conversation if I can into something that feels relevant. And that's not necessarily where everyone wants to go. And the important thing, if you have this personality, just for people listening, is you have to read your audience. If you're approaching them and they're backing away, change it to like, oh, what about the Dodgers? Anyway, there is this whole realm of morality and the idea of practical theology. And I would love to talk to you about that because it is an important thing. I mean, I've met medical ethicists. The rabbi that I was raised with, Rabbi Schulweis, I don't know if he coined the term, but it was his philosophy of what he called predicate theology, where you need to do something. If you know what matters and what hurts people and what they need, then it's not enough to pray about it and to think about it. You need to go and start a food bank. You need to be involved in going and doing the thing that's going to help relieve them of whatever it is that they're suffering with and be a part of the solution. So it was very action-oriented. That's not the way it is for a lot of people, and it's not the way it is for other Jewish communities, but that was how I was raised. I think that's why there are so many people who are Jewish who are activists. It's just sort of part of the tradition to a certain degree, but it's not easy. And a brief story that some people on the podcast have heard, it was an interesting thing, and then I want you to be able to take over and talk more. I was giving a talk at the National Association of Social Workers. They had their annual conference, and they asked me to come and talk about why people stay in situations that are really not healthy for them. I gave about 40 reasons, and then at the end said how it's also a question that I have trouble with, because the focus is on the victim. And let's move it to what it is about people that cause them to orchestrate situations that make people too fearful of leaving them. So I said, let's move it to looking at the other person involved or the organization involved, instead of just always focusing on the victim and why did you stay? What I found, though, was when I talked about what helps people heal from this and how they get empowered and how they learn to notice what they need to notice before they get more deeply entrenched in something unhealthy. And it helps you if you go to therapy or to group therapy to get past it, talk to other people who have been in these situations so you don't think there's something inherently wrong with you that you stayed in something like this. There were three women who were raised in the tradition. I was giving this talk in Arkansas. I'd never been to this part of the United States. There are three women who came forward who were very involved in their churches, and they were upset with me during the Q&A that I didn't talk about forgiveness as a way of healing. My feeling about forgiveness is that you do it if it works for you, if it helps you, but that it should be based on merit. It should be based on someone doing what we call in Hebrew tshuva, like repentance, coming forward and saying, I'm sorry, I acknowledge, I'll do this differently, and that you see them really working towards that. And they said, no, it doesn't matter what the other person does. You need to forgive. Afterwards, I had private conversations with them. They had all been in situations where they had been abused in their churches. And the whomever who it was who they went to, whether it was their pastor or some other title, just told them that they needed to forgive the person who did it to them. And in each situation, I said, what happened to the teacher, the choir director, the pastor who did this to you? I don't know. And I thought, it's so interesting, that's not part of the story. When we get into morality, I like that there is this need for also this practicality, like, how do we navigate these things in a moral way, I think, to really help people who have been victimized feel empowered and not feel that it's incumbent upon them to do the right thing in response and that that's what God wants of them. Kind of played with my head a little because it was not the way I was raised.
I'm very familiar with that. There's something to be said too about the way of telling the story of America. Forgiveness is not, in the Christian understanding, separate from the demonstration and establishment of justice. And that draws from the Hebrew tradition of shalom, not the absence of violence, but the presence of flourishing and that sort of positive vision. And yet, when we sort of adjust for the prominence of a certain sort of American culture, a certain story of America where, you know, if we look farther back into our past and even our present, the unequal scales of justice are just part of the equation. And there's a huge reception, I think, in white evangelical churches, particularly like middle and upper class, where the aversion to justice, or that what is politics, what does justice have to do with what it is to be Christian? What happens is they're put at odds, strangely enough, that justice is either delayed so that it can be denied in the present, and there's not really a place to make that sort of intervention, especially when a lot of my experience, I served in a church of 70, and then I served in a church of 2,500. Abusive dynamics can happen in any community, regardless of size. It doesn't have to do with necessarily the size of the community, because viewing a religious leader as the untouchable God's man. Again, I was in an expression of Christianity that denied at the time, and still does, denies women the opportunity to serve as clergy. And so there's a sense of patriarchy that runs through that, that men are above or beyond, a sense of accountability and how that plays out functionally. So I'm very familiar with that culture. I know all of the sort of theological explanations, all the superstructure that would enable predators to move from place to place without justice while forgiveness is preached. That story is just an emblematic. There's not enough data to capture that reality, and people will point to data. And I write about this a little bit in the book, that people want to point to data or statistics to sort of validate these dynamics, whether to judge whether or not they're pervasive or not. That's the difficulty I think that survivors always face. And I'm not identifying myself as a survivor. I'm simply just advocating for those whom I know, and this is part of their story, and simply just saying, how much data do we have to show, for example, to show that rates of abuse inside churches is not different at all from outside? And yet the stories that are told and incubated inside these communities is that is the quote unquote world. It's the non-Christian who's morally deficient, who cannot be trusted. And that can metastasize as a whole sort of contagion that when you then start to look at broader conspiracy theories about, you know, the election, I come to that one a lot. Its potency and plausibility inside evangelicalism broadly was that, well, regardless of whether or not we have evidence, the saying goes, you know, well, we think that people who identify or register as Democrats are morally the kind of people who would do that sort of thing anyway. As soon as you're able to make that association, then the plausibility becomes that much more easy to accept, because it's still about maintaining the internal purity of the community. That's exactly what those women experienced as well. That justice is something that's supposed to be handled here, we're supposed to forgive. There's real damage. From a theological perspective, it does cheapen both. It cheapens what we understand justice to be. It cheapens what forgiveness is. Because I think in some ways too, forgiveness offered to oppressors and abusers can be an understanding of the act that was perpetrated. I'm very familiar with the arguments that would platform and build up that sort of culture. It does leave survivors in those spaces with a sense of certainty, like, I did what I was told, this is what we're supposed to do. And it's hard to wade into that, because in some ways too, and I imagine you experienced this, Rachel, you're opening up wounds, and that's difficult.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And part of the ethical part of this, and I saw my ethical role in that moment, was to not take that away from them, because they really felt it worked. That's not going to work for everyone. It worked for them. You can have it, please, after whatever you've been through, have whatever makes you feel better. But I just thought it was interesting that three different people came up to me and were upset with me that I didn't offer it as a choice, this sort of automatic choice. And what I said to them too was, I don't think it was offered to you as a choice. It was offered to you as your obligation. But then I backed away. I think that's also part of the art of what you need to do, because you're tackling issues that are big, that are emotional. I'll say some of the most difficult sessions I've had have been with families where there is a member who is conspiratorial in their thinking and they cannot tolerate the conversation. They back away, they'll leave the room, they make these ad hominem attacks. Well, you're just stupid and you're this and you're a woman. And well, I don't know, whatever comes to mind, because they just are feeling so defensive. It's hard to have these conversations. So I want to move into that and how you became interested in that, and also how you deal with the emotionality of the topic.
Readers of the book will find that there's a huge space that I've tried to create to not immediately rush into the clinical. In my day job, I am a clinician in the sense that I'm in the medical industry. I understand what it means to discuss prognosis and diagnosis. And while I'm not a doctor in that sense, I'm not a medical doctor, but as a clinician and a chaplain, I understand that there are real diagnoses that feature with paranoid visions and things like that. And those are so far down the line from where we're actually dealing with some of these problems. Most of us are talking far beyond what we actually can when we dismiss someone and say, well, they're just crazy, or you're pathologically insane. Those terms get thrown around a lot. I think what's interesting, Rachel, is as I've held this book and written it, and the space that it tries to create for primarily those who are on the receiving end of the conspiratorial pitch, how do I account for what's happened with my pastor or with my friend or with my family member? How do I make sense of this? And I've heard from a couple of readers, because one of the sentences I put in the book in the introduction is, you know, if you're reading this book as sort of a resource for ammunition to win arguments, you've already lost. The goal of the book is not to give people a bunch of quick techniques to sort of undercut. The reason I did that is because I think that approach makes a huge assumption that's dangerous. And it's simply that the best way to displace bad information is with good information. And I'm not here suggesting that we shouldn't want to have good information. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that when it comes to addressing the wholesale effect of conspiracism on families and churches and communities, that facts are not enough in that sense, that you'll never be able to resource enough data, enough good information to really stem the tide of a torrent of high-processed information. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm writing at this from an ethical angle, from a theological angle, but gesturing towards the psychology will tell us that that sort of octagon, me versus you approach, the research just doesn't work. It actually leads to further retrenchment for both. Part of the reason that polarization has got to be the way that it is because there's a lot of profit involved in high processed information. There's that material point. But another reason at a lived level that we're experiencing this is that we've simply taken the putting on boxing gloves and say, like, hey, if I can just slug you with enough facts, then eventually, here's what I try to do in the book. Though, I'm not trying to fault people for doing that. Like, I understand. I've done it myself. I first began to encounter this, and I tell people that just as a child, it was in the water. You know, references to the Democrats, to liberals, it just went hand in hand with the Christian message that I was receiving as like, oh, this is what God says. This is who God is. But then when it came time to hear it as a pastor, but not just as a pastor, it was as a pastor in a particular moment, like during 2020. In that time, there was a lot of things being put on the table. There was the pandemic. There was the resurgence of the conversation about race in American history and in a present American moment. What I noticed across the board was that many people already knew. That sort of ideological combat of putting on the boxing gloves and just going at it, you only do that if you feel like you're certain of your position. The church, ideally, or the church understood as something created by God of Jesus Christ, that place, that community should actually be a place where minds can be changed, where the safety and belonging, say, I don't know, is par for the course. But that's not what I experienced. That's not what many people experience. And as a pastor, so what do you do when you start hearing, this was in Virginia, Spotsylvania County, where it was the highest per capita population of enslaved people in the Confederacy. I'm pastoring in this sort of environment.
What town was this?
Fredericksburg. There's the city of Fredericksburg, but then there's the county of Spotsylvania. And I think sometimes, particularly in white communities, the forged memory of civil rights and then the Civil War is just very much, it either happened yesterday or it happened so long ago that it doesn't matter. And it depends on what you're talking about. I remember my first week on the job, I heard, and I wouldn't classify this as a conspiracy theory, but what I heard was, oh, you know, the Civil War wasn't fought over slavery. It was fought over states' rights. What ends up happening is you have a certain smuggling in of a certain myth of America, a certain storied telling of American history. And when that gets fused with a certain telling of the Christian story and that you flatten that out into an ideology, it gives people a certainty. And here's my point, that resonates with the material media that people consume Monday through Saturday. And so as a pastor, we start talking about the need for predominantly white churches in a community to adopt a posture of understanding and listening when it comes to matters of race in America. Well, suddenly that's political. Now, how does that feature into conspiracy theory? Well, it features into conspiracy theory when you start to narrate what's going on in your town. You start to narrate what's going on up the road in DC. In the conversations about race, it dovetailed and overlapped in the conversations about child sex trafficking, which is a very real thing, but very much overlapped with the QAnon universe. You talk about the rabbit hole, it very much was. And as a pastor, you're sitting there thinking, I can't fact check this. I can't put on my fact checker hat every day. And Rachel, what I knew was that all of this that was being shared with me, and not always directly, it was socials, it was passing comments, it was all these sorts of things. But what I knew was, at the bottom of it, it was about, this is what good Christians believe. If you were more faithful or if you were biblical, these sorts of things would be what people would believe, you should believe. There was also the, well, we're not going to talk politics here. Let's shut this down. Let's talk about other things. So the thing about these spaces is that when conspiracy theory sort of erupts out to narrate something that people are seeing through the media, like, oh, this thing is definitely that, the assumption that drives its authority and plausibility is that this is what good Christians believe. And as a pastor, I knew that it wasn't necessarily in my job description to go and try and correct a bunch of spurious false facts. Not only was there not enough time for that, but I'm not an epidemiologist. Like, there were many things that I was not, and I'm still not. But what became apparent was that what was at stake, one of the reasons why people felt comfortable embracing these forms of seemingly alternative knowledge or counter narratives was because they understood and experienced it as resonant with a Christianity that they understood. Well, this is a counter narrative. That association, isn't Christianity sort of a conspiracy theory? That ran really deep. It almost was like a plausibility structure. It was almost like a permission to entertain certain forms of and certain claims that were treated as alternative or counter narratives or things like that. That for me began to say, well, there's actually something fundamentally at stake here in what it means to be Christian. If the suggestion is faithful Christians know that the election was stolen, or faithful Christians know that masking doesn't work, putting aside public health experts, putting aside epidemiologists, the basis for that claim cannot be Jesus Christ. It cannot be, well, faith over fear, don't mask up. I'm not here to regurgitate public health responses to the COVID-19 pandemic. I will say for listeners, like, I lived through two different responses, right? I lived half of it in the States, the other half in Scotland. So people who want to have that conversation, I find me amenable to say, I experienced two different, widely different public reactions to that trauma that we all live through. But as a pastor, when people are saying, well, I'm not going to mask, or I'm not going to do this because of Jesus, you're kind of sitting there thinking, that's not the rationality at play here. But the gap between it was bridged with alternative knowledge that people felt like was characteristic of Christianity. The conclusions that were being drawn from this theological association were so stretched, but a slogan is powerful and a story is powerful. In a lot of working through this, you end up grappling with how conspiratorial knowledge, if we would understand conspiracy theory as something that creates knowledge for a second, just consider that a conspiracy theory would create knowledge. Okay, well, what kind of knowledge does it create? Well, one of the characteristics of that knowledge might be like it's a counter narrative or it's a different way of approaching things. Well, when you get to that point, it's not so hard to see how if someone's understanding of Christianity is that it is a counter narrative, that it is telling the truth with its back against the wall, the world be damned, like this is what's really going on. When that sort of posture, which I experienced growing up in evangelical youth groups, when that's your posture, then conspiratorial knowledge almost sounds Christian in that sense. One of the things I want to say very clearly is that conspiracy theory, it has no ideological home. The right does not have a monopoly on this any more than the left. And the reason that I discuss evangelical Christianity in my book is, well, because personally, I was raised in it. I'm not picking this up as someone who's just, oh, well, like, let's pathologize these people over here. No, like, these are my people. And I'm going to talk about me and us. That's often the kickback is like, well, why aren't you talking about it over here, over there? And as an ethicist and a theologian, I end up sort of responding, well, saying, well, this is who I am. This is not me picking on particular subjects. This is me excavating my own experiences as a way of holding evangelicalism, the tradition I was from. Can we have this conversation? Can we talk about this as it pertains to us? Because one of the things that is evident is that regardless of how often people will hear evangelical Christians in public speaking about being persecuted, living outside of the United States for 3 years was enough to convince me that the persecution that is discussed is wildly out of balance with the amount of success that evangelical Christians have socially and politically in this country, and the amount of influence that it experiences, the amount of success that its movement, not just as a movement of religion, but a movement of religion allied with politics and allied with economics. It's incredibly successful as a political movement. It's incredibly wealthy as an economic component of that. All of that to say, conspiracy theory does not play favorites. We're all susceptible in some ways because there's all things that we want to believe. There's all things that seem easier to believe than others. And the argument that I make in the book is that what is very easy for evangelicals to believe is and are stories that align with what they already think about Jesus and his way of working in and through the world. What's happened in so many different ways is that a particular telling of the American story has become essential to understanding the Christian story as well. Both have been lost. Both have been distorted. The attempt of the book to hold space to reorient really begins and ends with a willingness to make the admission of, I don't know, to live in the midst of uncertainty as a way of being Christian. And the challenge with all that, however, is that there's always going to be an antagonism, a whataboutism that is more easily set up to justify yourself than it will be to deal with what's going on inside the community. I read a survey just this week that said 25% of Americans believe the most recent attempt on President Trump's life was staged. That number, 25%, is also the percentage, a quarter of white evangelicals in America also hold to some sort of component of the QAnon universe. When you break that survey down into the sort of how they understand the claims of QAnon, many of those things have Christian characteristics to them. People are believing these things because they believe they're a good, faithful Christian. It just has a characteristic that they're familiar with or resonant with. A couple years ago when QAnon was talking about there's going to be a revival, the elites are going to be swept away and all of this. Well, that tracks, that plays with a lot of the expectations that evangelicals have. All throughout the book, I'm making these sort of gestures towards this sort of knowledge that conspiracy theory produces as a way to sort of surface, we can't take our religious system for granted either. That there always has to be, and maybe a best way to sum it up is in speaking to Christians, is saying that Jesus delivers us from our Christianity too. And if we're not willing to recognize that, then we will be prone to sort of flatten institutions and ideologies and cultures all down into a sort of ideological posture that transforms us from mystics who are comfortable with mystery. That flattening transforms us into zealots with certainty. That's why our politics looks the way that it does. And that's why no one can trust reality in the broadest sense of the word. But Rachel, there's so many different ways to tackle this. I'm trying to keep myself from totalizing analysis here because there's so many other things at stake. This is me just kind of taking a seat at the table and saying, you know, psychologists have something to say here. Political scientists have something to say here. What does Christian ethics have to say? What does theology have to say? That little sliver is important. It also doesn't need to set itself up as totalizing, as if this is the only thing that can be said.
Wow. Okay. So well said. Jews are not unfamiliar with conspiracies and blood libel and all the things that have caused so much pain and death, actually, within our community. And same thing with minorities in general and people who are just the scapegoat over and over and over again. I wonder about things taking off like wildfire and what that's about. And I think the fact that you said the word certainty is certainly a big part of this. Something I've talked about a little bit on the podcast about was that there is a business called California Psychics. They have a lot of commercials. I found their commercials compelling because I could see how manipulative they were. They had a lot of facts and figures. They don't hire 95% of the people who apply. They only hire the top 5%. Like, there's no way to check that out. But the tagline is the joy of certainty. That was so compelling. So I looked up California Psychics to see who their advertising agency was. And it's an advertising agency, and shame on this advertising agency. I won't say the name. That hires social psychologists to manipulate the audience. It was incredible. You could hear they're trying every angle just to get people to pay into this. It's also reminding me just about how sometimes the truth is not as sexy. I don't know how else to say it. And there was a quote by Mark Twain that I love. I'm writing a book that I hope to have be out by February 2026. But in it, I have this quote because I loved it when I heard it. And I love Mark Twain quotes usually. And it was, "A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes." What is that about? What do we think about this and why that happens and why people don't question? They just jump in, like the whole January 6th. People were there. Oh, and also this thing about January 6th. And people hear this as me taking a partisan view. This isn't about being Democrat versus Republican. But I knew when Trump was there and he said to the people while he's rallying the crowd beforehand, before they charge, he said, "I will be right behind you." And I thought, no, you won't. There's no way. What? What are you talking about? But he said that, and maybe it was emotional, but these are the personalities that never get their hands dirty. They're not going to be along with this crowd. They're going to have people do their dirty work for them, or at least they're going to sit back and watch how many people are going to be doing something just because they said, and that is so validating for their ego. Again, not a political statement, but a personality statement. I have to do these disclaimers or I'll hear about it. So what is that about in human nature? And it's the, however, my $24,000 question, whatever, what do we do about it? But maybe there isn't something to be done, but maybe just to understand.
The question of the need for certainty, the desire for certainty, also the offering of certainty. So this is maybe the question. Because what this question does is it steps out of the partisan binary that we're in, and it is aware, I think, of the near total interface that we as modern people have with technology and with automation and just the technological society we live in. So for listeners who want to do some reading into what I'm about to say, I'm really riffing off of Jacques Ellul. And he wrote in the mid-20th century. I was thinking about him when you were talking about that personality on January 6th. Because, you know, Ellul, who also wrote on propaganda, says the time to seize an individual is when they are alone in the crowd. When we talk about why we want certainty, how it got to be this way, I may just ask people, when was the last time you went to Disney World? One of the Imagineers who built Disney World, or maybe it was Walt Disney's biographer, said that the goal of Disneyland and Disney World was not to build an escape from reality. It was to build a better reality. I'm going to say this as a Floridian. From the moment that you step onto Disney property, like, you have an expectation that everything just works. 9 times out of 10, it does. Everything's efficient. Travel's built in. You pay for all of that and then some. The whole idea of a Disney vacation is its own extraction operation. The company knows, because you cannot go to Disney World without your phone anymore, they can track all data. Their ability to engineer profit is all there. So I'm pointing people to Disney World, though, because I think it's an easier way to remind everyone that we all want certainty. And sometimes that experience of certainty is technological automation, it's convenience. One of the thoughts that I've found myself thinking since coming back to the States and being more immediately involved in the responsibility for our current situation is just the question of, well, could there be a mass movement for democracy? And I'm saying this as myself. So for listeners, I'm not going to check myself in that sense. And I appreciate Rachel doing that for the listeners, but I appreciate you giving me the freedom to simply say, if there needs to be a mass movement for democracy, or if there needs to be a mass movement for civil rights, can that happen when Netflix is still streaming? Can that happen when Amazon is still delivering? Those questions of certainty, I think, move beyond the traditional way of approaching this problem, as in, I hear this from both sides. When the book comes out, it's too hard on evangelicals. But then I hear from non-Christians, non-evangelicals, even non-religious people, right, who say, this guy still believes in fairy tales, so why are we listening to him? It's carving out this very difficult place My Substack is called No Man's Land, and that's intentional. It's not this space to dig these trenches. It's this very unprotected, perilous void, which is why Hagar's story is just so captivating to me, where we are able to sort of break this gridlock and experience uncertainty as a way of being human. And for me, then, as a way of being Christian, too. The promise of Disney World was actually way more than just a vacation destination. For people to understand Walt Disney, he was more like Elon Musk in the last 10 years of his life than he was George Lucas. He wanted to build a functioning city. He wanted to do a lot of the things that our tech barons are moving towards. But that whole city was premised on technological integration and automation and all of those things. And so it's helpful to recognize that when we're dealing with this desire for certainty, we account for the way that we experience technology, even if it's something we create. We experience technology the way our ancestors experienced the natural world. It's a second nature. That desire for certainty, for stability, the offer of technology to create that has actually turned around and driven us to a deep point of anxiety that we would have some place to stand and some stable place. It's precisely why the antidote of uncertainty is an invitation into realizing what it is to be human again, to embrace our limitations. It's not necessarily about rethinking our relationship to technology and those kind of activisms. What I'm really trying to get at is a conversation that has seemed off the table for a really long time, especially in Christian spaces, which is simply just that conversation about what is reality. Because high processed information is not designed to change minds as much as it's designed to reinforce a message. Our experience of deluge of high processed information is going to form us in a particular way. Well, there very much are, and I cash this out in the book, there are theological points of resonance as to why some conspiracy theories seem more attractive and why the demonization and dehumanization of particular groups of people could be understood as like, oh, this is what good Christians would advocate for, as terrible as that sounds. So there very much are like theological touch points that I'm almost primarily concerned with. I still want to create space, though, for acknowledging that there are real material questions at stake here, too, about our interface with technology and why, for example, a church that says, oh, we're not going to talk about politics, we're not going to discuss this, while people go out on their morning commute and listen to the same worship music they heard at their church on Sunday on one radio station, and on their commute back is listening to talk radio on that very same station that advocates for a particular ideology or whatever. That experience of consumption is its own sort of propagandizing. It's its own sort of formation. And this is maybe one of the overarching points that the book makes, is that we're talking about combating conspiracy theory. We're dealing with something that's a little bit more deep than just, well, let's meet bad information with good. And that's kind of a callback to an earlier conversation that we were having. But I think it's important to kind of lay out, yes, there's theological touch points that create a desire for a certain sort of conspiratorial knowledge. But at the same time, none of us are off the hook, because what unites modern people is this expectation for certainty, this expectation for automation, this desire for what we've called progress that should always be advancing in a very particular way. Maybe if I could code that theologically for a second, I mean, the expectation among evangelicals is always, this is going to happen in a couple of days, where there's going to be a rededicating of America to God event. And the question then becomes, well, which God? And then the question alongside that is that something that nation can actually do? When it comes to the ways that people have consumed conspiratorial content baked into a certain telling of the American story and the Christian story, when those images come across of what's about to happen, it forms people with a particular imagination to only look at that and conclude one thing, is that that's what we want more of. But as a Christian, I understand what the Christian faith is going to do is going to provoke a sort of unsettling. It's going to provoke an uncertainty, almost a disbelief in more than what we're probably comfortable in admitting. There's a lot there. I'm sorry, Rachel.
There's so much there. No, it's so important. It's so spot on. The rededication. Okay, so by the time people hear this, it will have already happened, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I remember hearing fairly recently that the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance was added pretty recently in the 1950s.
Can I tell a story on that?
Yes, please, please.
It was a Presbyterian pastor who advocated for its inclusion during the Cold War because it was like the 1950s, and he said, hey, like, under God, like, we need to defeat the communists. This is who we are, and Christianity is a plank of this country. Well, if you can go back and look, he marched with Dr. King, and he came out and said, you know what? I think I was wrong about that. And he kind of explained it on the basis of the anti-communist fervor was so strong. We were trying to assert ourselves. But then looking back in the midst of the civil rights movement, he could clearly see how the sort of combination of principled anti-communism evolved to be the direct antagonist towards the civil rights movement. So here was a man, right, who advocated for one thing and then found himself like changing his mind and saying, I'm actually not so sure about that anymore. It just kind of proves the point of this conversation, right? And everything that we've been talking about is that we don't really hear about the people who change their mind, but they do. And we do. Where is that story in the midst of this? People are going to see in this rededication what they expect, what they've wanted to see. And where does that desire come from? It comes from an imagination that has been curated and preserved and protected and promoted. And I think what's difficult, at least as I see, understand the work I'm doing, is that it very much feels like apostasy, what I'm calling and inviting people to be a part of, because it's a call out of a faith that really is what it is. That is very much in line with the message of the Hebrew prophets. I'm not casting myself in that role here. I'm just saying that that message delivered to one's own is always prone to misunderstanding. When you're baking in conspiracy theory with the American story and then the Christian story, everyone's been formed and consumed something to the point where a rededication ceremony in DC is what they've been longing for years, years and years. And I think about my work that makes it particularly difficult is its experience as a provocation that invites an apostasy. And it took me a while to realize, because of my own journey, that apostasy can actually be a good thing, that leaving can actually be its own form of conversion. Whenever religion sort of becomes a static thing, I'm thinking actually of the story in the Hebrew Bible where in Hezekiah, King Hezekiah went through some religious reforms. There was the staff that everyone sees on their ambulances because it's the staff that has the snake. And it was the staff that Moses lifted up in the wilderness when there was a plague. God told Moses, lift this up and everyone who looks to it will be healed. They kept that. Well, in Hezekiah's day, what had happened was that a cult of worship had emerged around that object. And so Hezekiah destroyed it. An artifact of such national significance. He was like, destroyed. I think that story sort of encapsulates the shock, the provocation of what this book represents in asking people to apostatize from a Christianity that has not just committed itself to America, but that has bound itself to a particular version of America that is experienced by others as terror. And the invitation to apostatize from that can be faithful. That's provocative. That's very subversive. But that's the space that this book creates for considering what that act might look like.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love this. And I love also talking about uncertainty. And that I do think, and if we speak again, I could imagine talking about, because you mentioned anxiety, that's so tied in with all of this, which I think is an interesting thing. And again, don't want to say that everyone who feels this way has anxiety, but that I think it is woven into just human nature to have this anxiety around uncertainty and not knowing. And thank you for sharing that story about the Cold War. And when you're young and you're sitting through history class and you're thinking, I don't know what, I don't need this, I don't care. But when you learn the connections between things, that I remember that communism was called godless, so then you need something under God. And then the religious leader who said that then says, well, actually, I think I was kind of reacting too. I was caught up in a groundswell, which is the whole thing about what we're talking about, also about conspiracy theories, about how we as human beings are drawn into things. It is a really important discussion. I'm so glad that you wrote this book. Where can people find it? And where can people find the work that you have online?
Thank you, Rachel. It's available wherever books are sold. You can buy it from the big box. You can buy it from your small indie bookstore. I've seen it on a couple here in Tampa. I've had messages from friends or family who said, oh man, you'll never... I love to see that, because the heart of the book is just about the intimacy and the personality of these sorts of conversations that I know are happening across kitchen tables, not just echoing down the halls of DC. It's available everywhere. I will say, though, I really recommend the Audible, the audiobook, which is available exclusively, I think, on Audible, only because the tone of my voice is able to communicate something totally different than what's on the page. Much deeper, and I really appreciate the ability to offer it in that format. So I'll say that. People can find me online at Substack, that's where I do a lot of my long-form writing, at No Man's Land, and then on social media, Jared M. Stacy. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Awesome, Jared M. Stacy. It's been so good to talk to you. It's so illuminating and it's so well thought out. And yes, and you do have a lovely speaking voice. And so I can imagine things come across in a certain way.
I had a great director. Thank you, though. I appreciate it.
Okay, that's great. Sure. Of course. Wonderful to talk to you. Hope we get a chance to do it again.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much to Jared for coming on the show, for sharing so much, for having such a great conversation with me about so many subjects. And I hope for him to be able to come back on to talk about a whole variety of other subjects. We talked about certainty, among other things, but it is a very important thing to be comfortable with uncertainty. It's a harder one. It's not something we are from birth wanting. We want to know. We want to know what the answer is. We want to know that things are right and things are wrong. We want to know that we're safe if we go this direction, unsafe if we go that direction. But what is true is that a lot of people will rush to conclusions from the start. They will love just being able to be given an answer. And that feels so satisfying that they don't question it, because they don't want to question it, because questioning it is going to bring up a whole variety of other anxieties. When people have a conclusion or an answer, they stop searching or they stop questioning a lot of the time. They seek that feeling of reassurance and cling to rigid beliefs at times, because uncertainty feels so uncomfortable, so uncomfortable. The human brain often prefers even a painful certainty over an unknown possibility. It's an exact kind of representation of the quote, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. Certainty, though, can cause sometimes for us to kind of close off too quickly, close off our minds, close off our inquisitive minds, our critical thinking. We then don't have curiosity and we don't pick up on nuance. We might not even be still searching for the truth because we think we have it, or at least close to it. But also, I think it keeps people from growing, from being able to expand their awareness, expand their mind. It's like a scientific conclusion where you don't just decide something and then move on. In science, you make room for new data that has come in and you kind of move over what you thought as the conclusion over to the sidelines. And absorb new information so you can come up with what might be a totally different conclusion. But there are some people who do not like to make a change. And there's some people also who have already gotten famous over having that conclusion, coming up with that scientific paper, deciding something, and then they are known for that or their name is associated with it, and so they just leave it. Learning to tolerate uncertainty, though, is an important part of emotional growth, but also emotional resilience. Uncertainty, I think, allows room for discovery. It allows us to pause before concluding, to pause before judging, to gather more information, to stay open-minded. But for some people, staying open-minded again creates anxiety. It's also good for people to realize if they have as part of their personality that they need an immediate answer rather than the right answer. Sometimes strength is not in knowing right away. It's in being able to sit with the discomfort of not yet knowing. When we become more comfortable with uncertainty, we become less reactive, less fearful, and less likely to be manipulated by people who promise absolute answers. Part of the reason that when we become more comfortable with uncertainty, we become less reactive and less fearful is because we don't have to hold on to something being the be-all and end-all. We don't have to worry that we are losing our anchor and we're going to sink, or we're going to just float off without anything tethering us anymore. But it's so important to learn to ask questions, to reflect, to wonder, and to trust ourselves enough to let clarity emerge over time and instead of forcing it prematurely. Thank you so much to Jared for coming on to the show. And again, I hope to talk to him again. And for all of you, take good care, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. Built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections. And it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are 3 tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.